My name is Robert. I'm a very grateful and happy alcoholic. Without help, it is too much for me. If that's too much for you, give me a holler there. It's been one of those days, I got to tell you. I got asked a couple days ago to be the 10-minute speaker for this meeting, and today was just a zoo at work. We're in the beginning of the year push there, and I had a bunch of stuff to do, and nothing worked out right, and I had to take all the computers to Sunnyvale, and I raced home and took a shower, and I got done at 8 o'clock. And I got here, and he said, there is no 10-minute speaker. And I go, oh, okay. So I started to get comfortable and miserable at the same time, and a few minutes later they said, there is a 10-minute speaker, but if you talk more than 10 minutes, they're going to throw shit at you. So here I am. I'm really glad to be here. So I was thinking, I hadn't really thought about Clancy from Venice. I grew up in Venice. That's where I did my time in the late 60s. It was a good place to be if you were my age and nuts. I was trying to think of encapsulating what I was like, what happened, and what I'm like now in 10 minutes. And what I'm going to do is what I think was, from as far back as I can remember, I was always trying to figure out what was wrong with me. There was something wrong with me. I just couldn't hang with other people. I just couldn't seem to put things together the way other people did. I was afraid of girls. I got good grades in school, you know, which made me stick out like a sore thumb. I was a nerd when I was a small child, you know. I wore nice clothes, and I was never real big, so I got beat up a lot, you know. And then I got real lucky at the age of, it was 11, 12, 13. I was at a party, and the parents had a philosophy that it's better that kids drink at home than in the streets. Love those people, right? You know, God bless them. And so they had left a bottle of vodka at this party for the kids, and they were pouring it into the punch, and I started drinking this stuff. And something happened to me that had never happened before. I became unafraid of anything, anybody, or anywhere. And all of a sudden, I was talking to one of those tall girls. You know how they are in junior high school. They're always taller than you are. And because I think I was about 5'5 until I got into high school. And I didn't have any hair on my body until I was like 17. I still don't have much. So I was talking and dancing with one of those tall girls, and they were great. I liked the tall girls. And I wasn't afraid of the guys anymore, and I didn't feel like that nerd that I'd always felt like. And also, I felt a part of rather than apart from. And I had never felt like that. My best friend was like on the chess team, you know? And people used to give me a hard time about hanging with those guys because they just, like, weren't with it. But I became a part of at that party. And what I remember is before the party was over, I stole the bottle of vodka and I split. And I went home, and my brother and I were camping out in the backyard like kids do, and he was about 10. And I got home and I said, try this, man. This stuff is great. And I handed him this bottle of vodka, and he took a big shot at the bottle, and he said, God, that's terrible. I said, you don't understand. Drink some more. And I was off to the races. I had discovered what was going to do for me what I was unable to do for myself. I had discovered what would make me feel a part of rather than apart from. I had discovered what was going to make me... You ever seen that? The Four Phases of Tequila? I love this t-shirt. It's two shots and I'm handsome. Four shots and I'm rich. Six shots and I'm bulletproof. And eight shots, I'm invisible, baby. And that's what alcohol did for me. Because I couldn't do that stuff without the alcohol. And I just took off. I took off, you know. I discovered alcohol, and I was off to the races. And at the age of 21, I discovered bars, women, and alcohol. It was the best combination I could figure out. And I just really took off. But I kept, through this whole time period, until I finally got sober, thinking there's something wrong, man. There's really something wrong. I can't quite figure out why I can't hang with these people. I was always trying to do stuff like go to church at 11 o'clock at night to ask God to save me. You know, they lock those places at night. It seems to me people need help all the time. You know, why do they lock churches? It's to keep wackos like me out of them when we're drunk. But I was always trying to find something that was going to fix the way I felt because nothing worked. And in the end, when I spent the last year of my drinking, I was married my last year, and I was married to this real nice little gal. And she used to beg me, please don't drink today. Just don't drink today. I'd say, okay, honey, I'm not going to drink today. Because I'd wake up in the morning, I was dying from the hangover. And I would go to work, and I would have to leave work about 9:30 and go get a couple of pops at the local bar. And I would come back to work, and at lunch, I'd go get a couple of pops. And I'd go get about 3, and about 5, I'd leave work, and I'd pick up a six-pack. And I'd drink that between work and home. And I get home, my wife say, you've been drinking. I go, no, I haven't. She goes, I can smell it on your breath. I said, well, I only had a six-pack. That's not drinking. And that was my feeling, was that that was not drinking. And then I could manage to hang together until she went to bed at 11 o'clock, and then I would go hit the liquor store. And in the last year, what I did was I sat in my car at night and drank after my wife went to bed, and I would go cruising in at 6 or 7 in the morning. you know, and she'd be screaming. I worked in the bars a lot, so I'd drink in the bars. I used to hear him say, after I got sober, you couldn't get struck drunk. But I remember real clearly going into the bar to work saying, I'm not going to drink tonight. And next thing I know, I was drunk, and I didn't know how I got there. I did not know how I got there. What happened for me was on July 10th, 1981, I got up in the morning, and nothing was really any different that night before than it had ever been. And I walked into the bathroom, and I looked in the mirror, and I had that moment of clarity. And I don't know if any of you guys ever had this, but I saw exactly what I was, exactly what I had been, and exactly where I was going. I screamed, God, I'm dying. Please don't let me die. I end up on the phone to Alcoholics Anonymous, and I called them, and I said, where are you guys? And they gave me the address. I didn't know they'd come get you, you know. I didn't know they had, like, taxi kind of services like they do these days. And I went down to the central office, and I talked to this lady who was about 300 years old. And she'd been sober probably that long. And for about 2 hours, I cried, and she talked. And she started telling me some things there in the beginning. First off was that if I had the shakes to eat some honey, that was going to help. But at one point during this couple hours, she says, we just don't drink one day at a time. And I got up to leave. I got up to leave because I was incapable of doing that. I'd been trying to do that off and on for the last year. And she says, where are you going? I said, I can't do that. I can't go all day without drinking. I just can't do it. And she says, sometimes we don't drink for 10 minutes at a time. And so I sat back down, you know. I hadn't had a drink in 6-7 hours. I figured I could handle another 10 minutes. And I went to my first meeting that night. And at my first meeting, she said, go to this meeting. You're going to meet a guy named Harry T. He'll be wearing a Hawaiian shirt. And I went home. I love this. I went home. I told my poor little 4'11", 100-pound wife that I was going to Alcoholics Anonymous. I'm going to stop. You know, I'm finally going to stop. And so we went to this meeting over at 400 West Campbell, Friday night candlelight meeting. I walk in. I swear there's 150 people in the room. There's 6 guys in Hawaiian shirts. I looked at my little wife, and I said, I'm getting the F out of here. And I started heading for the door. And she grabbed a hold of me and started screaming, is there a guy named Harry here? Little did she know it was the beginning of the end for her, unfortunately. But today we're friends, and it worked out. They took me and sat me down in a chair. And when they called for newcomers, somebody grabbed me by the arm and shoved me up out of my chair. And said, tell them what your name is. I said, my name's Robert. He says, now tell them you're an alcoholic. And they used a word in there right after that one. And I said, I am an alcoholic. And they sat me back down, and all of a sudden, I got some relief. And I started doing some things. I got 7.5 years clean and sober today. You know, a little more than that. And what I've been looking at the last couple of days is the action in my life over the last few years, you know. I've got some things that are going on, you know. 7.5 years sober, it's not always really perfect. It's not always really great. I got some new things happening. They talk about the peeling of the onion, you know, and I'm back to another piece of that damn onion, you know. And what I was thinking about last night was the action that's going on. What's happened now is that the threshold of pain is a whole lot less than it was when I got here 7.5 years ago. I can't take the pain anymore. I can't stand the way I used to feel. I don't want to feel like that. And I'll stand for a short period of time now and see that there's something going on that needs to be changed, some action in my life. I've changed a whole lot of the action in my life. You know, I had the discovery portion and then the action portion. And what's happening is at this point, it's been real calm, I guess. Somebody tell me, 6 months, a year, I haven't screamed at anybody too much lately. So it's been calm for a while, and all of a sudden what I'm seeing is it's coming up again, and there's more stuff going on, and I get a little deeper level of understanding and knowledge. And the first part is I'm aware that there is something wrong. And I get to make a choice right now. Do I want to suffer through this, you know, or do I want to take some action and make some changes? And that's what I want to do today, is I want to take some action. I've found that I want to be somebody I never, ever wanted to be. When I got sober, I was about 6 months sober, and I was sitting with my sponsor, and I said, you know what, I don't know who I am. I know I'm not who I was, but I don't know who I am. He said, I want you to go around and make a list of all the things that you admire in other people and you see in the program. And I started working on this list, and I picked real strange things out, like John C. and his spirituality, you know, and I was like, right. But I put it on the list. Because deep down inside, there was a little guy that wanted to do that. And I saw compassion in somebody else. And I saw understanding. And I saw a lot of things I put on this list. I went back to my sponsor and I said, here's the list. And I waited for the great words. We always say, I don't know about you guys. I say with my sponsors, I wait for them to give me the answer. And it's always really like inane little things like, well, you are. And what he told me was, he says, you are all these things, you just don't know it. And I'm like, that's it? You know? But I found out that he was right. I am those things, and I just didn't know it. And today what I want to be is more of those things. You know, what I really want to be is a spiritual being. What I really want to be is calmer about my life. You know, I don't. And I'm going to tell you the truth, I want a Testarossa convertible, all right? But I want to be happy getting that, you know? I don't want to set the goal and go for that and forget everything else. I want to enjoy the journey a little bit today. My life is completely turned around. Today, I have found the answer, you know, with the solution to my life. Alcohol was an answer for me for years. Alcohol killed the pain for a period of time. Alcohol stopped working for me, because I got to tell you the truth, if it was still working, I wouldn't be standing here, you know? If I was still having fun drinking, I wouldn't be standing here. And today I realize when there's things going on in my life, I have a couple of options. You know, to try and suffer through the pain a little longer, go drink, or take some action and do some things. You know, I remember the last night it hit me real strong. My first sponsor, I used to say, well, and he'd hand me the big book. This guy used to beat me in the head with his book. And he'd say, where in here does it say, now we take a break? It talks about vigorous, you know. It talks about launching, you know. It talks about into action. That's what it talks. And there, it doesn't say now we take a break. And what I keep saying I want a break, but it doesn't happen for me. But the other thing is, I don't want to feel the way I used to feel. You know, if you're new here, what I want to tell you is, you got a chance to change your whole life if you really want it. If you're willing to do some work for it, because it's not going to come easy. You know, it's not going to come easy. And I'm just really grateful to be sober and to be here. Thank you.
I've never had the opportunity to hear this gentleman, but I'm really looking forward to it because I've heard nothing but good things about him. So, tonight's speaker, Clancy.
My name is Clancy Imsland, and I'm an alcoholic. I'm very glad to be here tonight. I see a lot of young people here tonight. I know that you young people are the future leaders of AA. I'm so glad I won't be here to see it. And I'm very glad to be here at what appears to be the court card capital of the world. While I'm here, could you just have this signed to it? I'm always glad to be at a meeting where there's a lot of court cards, because that indicates there aren't very many alcoholics at that meeting, just a lot of people who've had bad breaks and misunderstandings. I've been persecuted by the fascist police department. It's kind of an interesting thing, because, you know, real alcoholics should have court cards, because, you know, if any of you got stopped with these traffic things that they have in California now, where they stop you arbitrarily, do they have them up here where they have the drunk checks? Those are not designed to catch people like me and alcoholics. They're designed to catch social drinkers. They're designed to catch people who are out there who don't know how to drive. They're on their annual drunk. And they're bumping into posts and trees. And while decent, experienced people like me have to sit behind them and say, "Hurry up there!" Yeah. It's just I want to thank Jim, my friends Jim and Bruce, and my new friend Sally for picking me up at the airport tonight and taking me to dinner. I barely finished half of my food, and one of them had it in his doggy bag and taking it home. I'm not going to say who it was, but it wasn't Jim or Sally. No wonder you need a lot of dental work, Bruce. You're eating week-old meat all the time. But we are here tonight, I want to commend Robert. That was a fine talk. Really, it could be said that you've heard all there is to hear about AA when you got done talking. We came here, we drank, we found drinking to be something special. It almost killed us. We got here and we stayed sober. That really is the message of Alcoholics Anonymous. But he only had 10 minutes. He used 11, unfortunately. I didn't care for myself, but I worried about the secretary. I knew she must be sick with anticipation. But it's kind of nice to be here in a room full of people like this. And it's an amazing thing. It's an amazing thing. It wasn't very long ago, and I'd like to mention this year a lot. In my lifetime, I'm old, but I'm not as old as a glacier. That's a stunning outfit. My taste goes for that sort of thing. That's why I live in Venice. I want to tell Robert one thing. I live up the other end of Venice. I don't live down with you weirdos and pukes on the beach. I live up where people have gardens and grow pot. But in my lifetime, it's hard to remember. There, see? That's what they mean when they say action is the magic word. I said action, the mic started to work again. But in my lifetime, in 1932, a rich family in the East had a son. They wanted to send him to the best doctor in the world because he seemed to have a lot of emotional problems which caused him to drink too much. So they found the best doctor in the world. Stand over there, yeah. Put your finger there in that fuse. But they sent this kid to the best. They gave him a blank check. All the money they want, doctor, cure our son. So the what causes that? I don't know what happens. When I come to San Jose, I get weird. I don't know what it is. Everywhere else in America, I'm spiritual and good. But I get around you people and I guess I want to blend in or something. But they had this kid in the hospital for a year. And they released him. Sent him back to New York. And he didn't even make it to the ship. He was face down drunk in his own vomit in a bar. And his family was aghast. And the doctor was aghast. And he was aghast. The family sent a new check to the doctor. Said, something must have gone wrong. Help our boy. And the world's greatest doctor in 1932 told the parents and told the boy, Roland, said, I'm sorry, I misdiagnosed your case. I thought I could help you. I thought you had severe emotional problems, and I could have helped you. But I see now my diagnosis was wrong. I now have come to believe that you are what is known as an alcoholic. And to the best of my knowledge, there is no help available to you in the world today. Can you imagine that? In 1932, the best doctor in the world had never heard of anything that ever worked for alcohol problems. Alcoholism. There were treatments, there were Keeley cures and cures, but they get people sober and they always got drunk again. And it's kind of staggering when you stop and think. That was just 56 years ago? 56 and a half years ago? And there wasn't... I think it's safe to say that probably there are more sober alcoholics in this room tonight than there were in the United States at that time. And he said, Roland said, what does this mean, doctor? And the doctor said, well, I'm afraid I have some very sad news to tell you. You must either voluntarily or involuntarily keep yourself restrained or under confinement as long as you live, or else you almost certainly will intermittently drink until you die or go mad. Now that's kind of a bad, that's bad news to get. He said, is there no way out? And the doctor gave him one. He said, there's one other alternative. He said, but you cannot count on that. And he said, in the literature, there are cases of people like you who have had immense, involuntary, psychological reversions. These people call them spiritual experiences. He said, they somehow stay sober, but nobody knows why. He says, it's maybe one in a million, maybe one in 5 million. He said, Roland, your chances of being hit by lightning are better than finding a spiritual experience. You cannot count on that. Now, that's the way it was just 59, 56 years ago. And this was after people had been working on the problem of alcoholism for 5,000 years. And that's why it's so kind of amazing. We have such a tendency to take it for granted. 50 years ago, last fall, a guy sat down and wrote this book. And it's truly, as I've often said, I conceive it to be a miraculous book. I didn't used to. All of my life, I have been a professional writer. That's what I've done. I've written in advertising agencies and radio and television corporations. And so I was not fascinated by the book Alcoholics Anonymous the first time I read it. I hear people in AA say, well, it's a badly written book. It is not a badly written book. It is just a terminally dull book. Just dull. Dull. I write things. All of my life I write things. Do it now. Take this action. Do this. Buy. Down. And there's nothing. You read this by the hour, for Christ's sake. If you are thorough at this stage of your development, you can... I have never much liked that book. Some years later, through a series of bad breaks and misunderstandings, I was on Skid Row in Los Angeles. And they had me read that book again. And you know what I found out after all those years? It was still a terminally dull book. I read it and... I gave up on the book, but I unfortunately had a sponsor who intimidated me into taking actions I didn't believe in. And I fortunately survived. And over a period of time, as I read that book again a few times, it really gets smarter every year that you stay sober. It really does. And by the time I was 8 or 9 years sober, I'd come to the conclusion, I remember telling a guy I was sponsoring, that knowing what I know, what I knew then about AA and what I know now, to the best of my knowledge, this book is one of the, if not the only book, certainly one of two books that I've ever believed, I've come to believe, is truly divinely inspired. Now, I don't say that lightly. I'm not one of those people who see a miracle behind every bush. You know, you hear people today say, I saw another miracle this morning. The sun came up, and I said, it's a miracle. I said, oh, shit, that ain't a miracle. That's the sun coming up. A miracle is supposed to be something inexplicable, unexplainable. But I believe this is a miracle, and the reason I think it's a miracle for a couple of reasons. And that is this. The man who wrote this book did not know enough to write it. He was a failed stockbroker, and he was about 3 years sober, and he had surrounded by a few tattered followers. There was a few tattered followers out in Akron, Ohio, and they milled around aimlessly. And they wanted to get this book written so that somehow they could make some dough, maybe, and transmit what they'd found so they could start some hospitals and make some big dough. And the guy that wrote it just sat down and he observed the people around him, most of whom were dying from alcoholism, just as an example of his own fallibility when he was writing about what he knew. At the beginning of this book, it says, we are a group of over 100 men and women who stayed sober for a year, and on and on. Some years later, he admitted there were only 79 people sober a year. But 100, he thought, would sound more impressive. We all understand that. But he wrote this book. But when he got into writing in the book, he wrote something that is he didn't know enough to write. And as I like to say, you know, if you're new tonight, and there are some new people here, you think to yourself, well, Jesus, if a person can stay sober 3 years, he should know enough to write a book by then. Let me tell you some news about that. By the time you're sober 3 years, you'll be amazed at how much there is you don't know yet. By the time you're 5 years sober, you just patronize people 3 years sober. You say, still going to meetings, Billy? Keep it. By the time you're 10 years sober, you hate to send people 3 years sober to get your coffee. Thinking about it, was that two sugars and one cream or two creams? Oh,
never mind, you asshole.
By the time you're 20 years sober, you hate to have people 3 years sober unattended on your property. Yeah. Nothing personal, just want to see how they're going to turn out. And this guy wrote a book that he had no knowledge of, wrote a book. The book in itself doesn't mean much except for one thing. Here's the miracle. In the 50 years since this book has been written, it has changed more alcoholic lives than all other therapies combined in the history of mankind. Now that's a miracle. And the biggest, you know, the saddest thing about it is, it is written for people like you and me, and we come to AA and say, what a dull book. Do I have to read it? Because that's, unfortunately, it's designed to be read by human beings. And human beings are a pain in the ass to one and all. And always have been. And always will be. And especially, I'm sure there are, I want to talk tonight to the people with the court cards. These other old timers, they doze off anyway. I want to talk to my fellow non-alcoholics. There goes one now. Just get it signed and get out. I tell you, Jim, the way it's going, you better get the car started and I'll be out in just a minute. But I joke about winding up on Skid Row, but I'll tell you. The last day I drank, I stood outside of a Skid Row mission where I'd just been thrown out. And as I was thrown out of that mission bodily, and I felt bad, I didn't have any front teeth, they'd been kicked out in the Phoenix, Arizona jail a couple weeks before that. When the guy threw me out of this mission, I said, hey, I'm not a bum. 3 years ago, I was on the faculty of the University of Texas directing a grand opera. I'm a well-known writer. Ads that I wrote are running in Life magazine right now. I'm a sports writer. I've written for sports. I've got a wide variety. I'm not a bum. I've had my picture in the New York Times. How many people do you know had their picture in the New York Times? But it's hard to explain these things in midair. Especially when you have no front teeth, you can't really hit those consonants the way you'd like to. When I stood outside that mission, there was a night similar to this, kind of a dull rain, a morning similar to this. And if a man would have come along with a lie detector and put it on my arm and said, your life is at stake. Are you an alcoholic? I said, no, I'm not. And that needle wouldn't have quivered a 16th of an inch. Because I'd been going to AA for 9 years by that time. And I knew that I was an alcoholic, but I wish I were. I wish I were an alcoholic. I wish I were something simple instead of being such a mass of complexities that it's always too much. I spent a lot of years examining myself because I didn't like to be uncomfortable. I don't know anybody that does. And I spent thousands of dollars in psychoanalysis to get to the root of my problems, why I was this way. I got into metaphysics one time. I was about half crazy by that time, so I had a real head start on the rest of them. I don't like to brag. It's tough enough to live in San Jose without having people come up here to brag, but at one time, to the best of my knowledge, I was one of six people in the state of Texas who knew truth. And they were so sick with envy, they put me in the insane asylum. I did a lot of things, because I don't like to feel the way I feel. As far back as I can remember, I only wanted to be a good guy, feeling good, and then being a good father, and having good kids, and a good marriage, and a good job, and that's what I wanted to be. And instead, I wanted to be a good guy living in a good world, and the world makes it impossible for you to be a good guy. The world screws you around, and you better screw them before they screw you. And people are strange and weird, and I have a lot of emotions. I spent a lot of time thinking about my emotions. For example, I spent a lot of time thinking, why am I so goddamn sensitive to everything? I try to pretend I'm not, because that's one of the marks of being sensitive, ultra-sensitive. You got to pretend you're not, otherwise you're like a wimp. But it doesn't bother me. You know something? I wouldn't want to talk about this anywhere where there are decent people. But just people like you and me here, so. One of the things that I'd never even thought of in my drinking age, until I was sober a while, and suddenly looked back and realized I didn't do it anymore. But I had an almost perpetual state of diarrhea most of my life. Not from having the flu, but that grinding and grinding and emotions and just never letting up. And one of the good thing about it is you can eat anything and never get fat. You know, just. People are on diets, you say, I'm sorry for you, I can eat all night. You know. It's really a drag when you get to be serene now. I just have a crust of dry bread and a glass of water. And but I've always feel things too intensely. See, other people seem to take them in stride. It's as though I got no insulation on my emotions somehow. I have a lot of anxiety. I have a lot of feelings about things. I want things to be right, goddammit. And when they're not, it makes me crazy. You know. I'd like there to be love in the world. And when there isn't love in the world, I'd like to just take an Uzi machine gun and say, sons of bitches! You know, can't you be decent? And one thing I liked about going to psychoanalysis, I discovered reasons why I had these emotions. People say you shouldn't go to a psychiatrist, but God, I made breakthroughs that just made me tingle. I discovered I'd been repressed as a child. I'd never known that. And when I found that out, it really made me cross. I was religiously repressed. I was in a very strict religion. The Norwegian Lutheran Church. Most of you have never heard of the Norwegian Lutheran Church. You hear the Catholic Church. Our dropouts became Catholics. I don't know if it's true or not, but it sounds true. They say Norwegian Lutherans are people who, even if they're married for 30 years, would never make love standing up. Just in the fear that some passerby would think they were dancing. It's a tough church. I discovered in the 1950s that I had been psychologically scarred by the Depression. I was raised. I didn't even know there'd been a Depression until I heard about it from my psychiatrist. But once I heard about it, it really made me sad. I've had so many things. It's so sad. I discovered all sorts of reasons. In fact, I'm kind of. The only thing I'm sorry about now is that I. I wish I'd lived now. If I was growing up now, just say I could have become an ACA and gone another 20 years and just... Their fault. I'm not putting down ACA. I think it's a marvelous organization. I was talking to Dr. Bob's son, whose name is also Bob Smith, by not coincidence, and I asked him, did you ever join ACA? He's an oil man in Texas now. He said, no, I decline to be permanently fixed as a sick teenager. Which, well, that's Dr. Bob said. What does he know? But I'm thinking of starting a group called Adult Children of Norwegian Lutherans. We can sit around and discuss our repressions. But I discovered a lot of things there. And it's nice to know these things. Later on, I got into metaphysics, as I said. And I discovered deep intensities and the infinity of the universe and the soul and the essence reaching out. And we used to sit around on porches late at night, and five or six of us, and talk and drink red wine. And then the sun would come up, and we all, like Dracula, had to hurry back to our caskets, you know, get our wife up to go to work. Best help in my life, something I discovered when I was a boy, 15 years old, early in the Second World War. I stood on the deck of a ship in Pearl Harbor, and some grown-up men got me to take a drink, and it stayed down, and that is the first time I ever found what I was looking for. Alcohol, I didn't know at the time, it seemed to fill my holes. I had no idea then, and I didn't have any idea for until I almost died, that is an unnatural reaction. You're not supposed to get that kind of a reaction from alcohol unless there's something wrong with you. It just seemed to be fine. I'll tell you something. Alcohol is the best friend I have ever had. Now that sounds terrible to say that in an AA meeting, but I'll tell you, friends come and go, jobs come and go, wives come and go, cities come and go, but a few drinks, when it makes you feel the way you must, that momentary omnipotence that nothing can make you feel like. Just great analogy Robert used about, you know, you actually get the bullets bouncing off you and you become invisible, fearless. Just something about that. And I thought I just, now that I had problems and knotted problems. The only problem I ever had is I sometimes seemed to drink too much. And then I got in trouble, and then well-meaning people said, you know, probably your problem is drinking. So I thought it might be, so I stopped drinking. And I realized drinking is not my problem. The things that give me these conflicts are the problems. And the people, and the unfairnesses, and the people screwing me around, and the situations, all the things. And I trouble. And said I could do it. Now, you people tonight who are new with the court cards, you may wonder, what the hell do you have in common with all these people? Well, what do all these people in the room have in common? What do all the people at an AA meeting have in common? Did they all drink a lot of whiskey? Some did, some didn't. It isn't what they drank. Is it where they drank? Nope. Is it what it did to them? Nope. Some people have been in jails and insane asylums. Some people haven't. Some people lost their families. Some people wish they could. Some people have lost everything. Some come to AA still making 250 grand a year. But they all have the one element in common that makes us here. The one thing that's so surprising to people. And that is this. It's something mentioned in chapter 3, a little sentence. The guy observed 50 years ago and wrote it down. Didn't know what it meant. But today I have come to believe it's the single unifying characteristic of every alcoholic I have known. It's just this. All of us who are alcoholics have at one time or another, and usually again and again, found ourselves in a situation where without our knowledge, for our own survival, we had to voluntarily accept and in the obsession that somehow, someday, I will control and enjoy my drinking. As the book said, the persistence of this illusion is astonishing. But why would people do that? Why would people drink? People who live with people like us. People who love people like us. How can you do that? Look what you're doing to yourself. You swore you wouldn't do it here. You're doing it again. Why would you do that? The terrible analogy in this book. One of the few things in this book that just makes me cringe every time I read it. It's true, but it's a goofy analogy about the jaywalker going on, boom, boom. You feel like saying, stop it, you asshole. You know. It's hard to remember that's the way we look to our loved ones, you know. No more after this one. Why would anybody do that? Why would anybody do that? In chapter 3, they also talk about things people have done to try to get around it. Try taking more physical exercise and reading spiritual literature and going on a trip and not going on a trip and swearing off with and without a solemn vow and never drinking at work and only drinking away from home and on and on and on. Why would they do that? To something that's killing. And I'll tell you, there isn't anyone like me alive who doesn't eventually wind up and saying, I don't know what the hell's wrong with me, but it's something a little more complex than stuff like this can help. I know they mean well, and they're nice people, but beneath the surface, I'm not like them. I suppose if there's any one thing in the world that most of us have felt, let me put it this way. 50 years ago, there was no place for people like you and me to go. People had to die or go mad or be confined. People like us. Today, there's AA everywhere. There's AA in Europe. There's AA in all... This year, in February, I was on a speaking tour in New Zealand. They all talk funny, but they're talking about the same steps we're talking about. In October, I was in Scotland and gave a little talk in that town when that plane went down, among other places, and glad I got out of there in time, you know. If I'm not telling the truth, may the heavens strike me dead. But I was in Glasgow and Dublin and Belfast and London, AA meetings, and all over the world there's AA, all over the world. But the greatest part of AA in the world is California. There are more AAs in California than the next 2.5 states combined. And it's growing all the time. This is the center of Alcoholics Anonymous in the world. Mostly Southern California, however. If you can't stand truth, get out of here. But you know, sometimes you get the feeling, you hear people say, I thought, isn't that the heart of AA? Akron has the same relationship to AA that Bethlehem has to Christianity. Something nice happened there once, but not for a long time. But today, it's no longer necessary, obviously, for people to go mad or drink. You don't have to die anymore when you're an alcoholic. You have to go mad. If you can't go right to AA, if you've got insurance, you can work in through a treatment facility where they will ease you in more gradually. If you can't afford that, there seem to be freelance counselors behind every bush. Spring up and put a hip. But there's no reason for anybody to die. And the most startling and frightening fact I know about alcoholism is this. Today, with all the help available, and with all the people sober, there are sober. It is estimated that about 95 out of 100 alcoholics in America die drunk. That's today, after all the help. And I'll tell you some news, folks. A lot of people in this room are going to die drunk tonight. I'm not saying... till you just about go crazy. When I went to the insane asylum in Texas, I didn't go there for drinking. Nothing on my commitment paper said a thing. My wife was pregnant again. I was about to lose my job at the university if I didn't stop drinking. I had to have that insurance for the birth of my child. So I went on the wagon one more time. I read books. I got metaphysics. I went to AA a couple times. But by that time, AA was way beyond any hope I had there. And one day, I couldn't drink, and I couldn't stand it. My wife took the children to church, and I just got it. I just pulled the car in the garage, hooked up a hose, turned the motor, and went to sleep and died. That's the only thing I could think of to do. And a neighbor happened to see me go in there and heard the motor running. I didn't come out. And he looked in the window, and I was at the wheel, and he kicked open the door and pulled me out dead. Beat on my chest and breathed my mouth, and they rushed me to the hospital, examined me for a couple days and gave me a lot of oxygen, transferred me to the psychiatric ward, examined me for 2 weeks and determined I was what they considered a badly split personality, a schizophrenic, and committed me to the Texas State Insane Asylum in Big Spring, Texas. And nothing on North commitment paper said drinking, because I hadn't had a drink for some time. But the point I'm trying to make is, that's how I get when I stay sober too long. That's not an alcohol problem, folks. That's something else. In fact, I've often thought about that. I'd like to go back and find that psychiatrist sometime and just... He must be old and feeble now. I should be able to move him around pretty good. Pick him up and say, "You quack! You identified me as a dual personality? Ha! You should lose your license. If I could have got my personalities down to 2, I'd have made it." Right. My problem has always been when I'm sober too long, a committee forms in my head immediately. "What do you think we ought to do?" "No, I don't. Let's get out of here." "Can't do that. I'm waiting." I hear people at AA say that they think they needed group therapy. Christ, I never have. I just go for a ride alone in my car. That's one of the reasons I drink, because it becomes one voice. It may be a bad voice, but it's one voice. The voice may say, "Quit your job and tell them to stick it up their can." But at least it's one voice. And I don't want to drink. Talk about it. I was thinking about this a few before we show. One morning when I was a young man, married, had a couple kids. I've been out, as it was, drunk. Got in a fight with a cop, put in jail. No big deal. But it was embarrassing and humiliating. My family was also, my mother and father were religious, and they were so saddened by me. But this morning, my father came out of the jail at 6 o'clock in the morning. He'd never done that before. Never come to jail. And I thought maybe he's going to take a new tack and help me, bail me out. He said, "Did you have a good time while you were out drunk last night, son?" I said, "No, Dad, I really didn't. I got in a fight with a cop. It's just a dumb thing. But it won't happen again, Dad, I swear." He said, I hope it won't for your sake, but he says, "It's too late for you. While you were out drunk last night, your little son died at home. And if you'd have been there, it wouldn't have happened. And I never want to see you again." He walked out. And that morning in that jail cell, I walked up and I was just about crazy. Because I loved that little girl and little boy. And my little boy died. And a couple days later, they had a funeral. Right around Christmas. And my in-laws came in and everybody's pretending it hadn't happened. I don't know if you've ever been in a situation like that. Where you sit around and people pretend it hasn't happened. But they look at you. And every time you just see that contempt in their eyes. And how did my sister get in with a son of a bitch like you? They don't say a word, but it's there. And after the funeral, in cold climates like Wisconsin, they do not bury you in the wintertime because the ground is frozen. They put you in a mausoleum, and when the spring comes and it melts, they dig graves and put in. And I have this little son, they're going to carry this little casket in. I said, "Don't go, don't carry it." And it's just so remorseful. And I carry the little casket in. I put it in there on the shelf. I put my hand on the top and I said, John Emersland, I swear to God this will never, ever happen again. I vow with my life, son, I'll make it up to you. And 31 days later, I was face down, 300 miles away, drunk, crazy. People couldn't understand why. What the hell are you, the devil in you? And I didn't understand why. I didn't know what I knew now, is that drinking relieves terrible problems, even if the terrible problems are caused by drinking. It's a funny paradox. And I couldn't stand that. And people, again and again in my life, I've seen there certainly, but another much less dramatic case. But one of the things you get sick of in life is watching, seeing that look of disappointment on people's faces. When they see it, you're worshiping. Oh, how could you? You just, there's no answer. Just leave me alone. Leave me alone, God damn it! How could you do this? On and on. And I got out of that insane asylum in Texas finally, and I got another big job, and on went. Problems, curses. One day my wife took the children and left me. I remember that day because I remember thinking, we've got a bunch of kids by now. We had a whole family full of daughters, and I thought, this is God's way of punishing me for killing my son. God, I just hated that. And I didn't know what to do, but she left. And I was so glad I came off a drunk. I came home, there's nobody there. And I thought, two feelings. How could they do this to me and I need help so bad? And the other one was, I'm glad she got those kids away from me before I do it again. And a couple of weeks after that, or a month after that, I was on the floor of the Phoenix drunk tank, and a guy was kicking my front teeth out. She said I'd vomited on his bunk. That was one of the few mornings I was glad I'd been in psychoanalysis, because I was almost instantly able to identify his problem. I remember thinking, this son of a bitch is overreacting. And a month after that, I was thrown out of the Skid Row mission. I said, but I'm not a bum. I'm not a bum. I stood in the cold rain in an old t-shirt. I'd lost my clothes, and an old pair of pants and some old frayed shoes. I thought, I wish I were an alcoholic. I wish I were anything except just somehow terminally goddamn evil. Because I don't want to be. I'm good. I really am good, but I'm just evil. And I walked 71 blocks to get out of the rain like this, out to an AA club that I'd been asked to leave a week before. Because when you look that bad, you have to go to AA club. There's no place else you can go. And they decided to let me in. I hung around the goddamn club. And I got out of the nut house in Texas by pretending finally to be an alcoholic and got their alcoholic ward. So I went to this club and I decided to pretend to be an alcoholic. And I played their sick little game with them. I lived in a parking lot in an abandoned car. I got a sponsor who seemed, he was a character actor in the movies. He always played nice roles. I thought, he'll be just the man. He'll be a surrogate father. The father that was, I never had. My father was too mean. And he turned out to be a power drunk, crazy son of a bitch. I tried to say, now listen, Bob. What you're telling me, I know you think is right, but in my judgment, I don't think that fits my case. In your judgment, you live in an abandoned car. Who gives a shit about your judgment? I fixed him. I said, oh, yeah. You could just see him turn white. But he made me take actions and do dumb things. And I read that book again and did dumb things and stupid things. And little by little, I had no idea I was taking steps of AA. I just humiliations and problems and goofinesses and surrenders. And somehow I got a gift that I really didn't deserve. But I got it. I hope you have it. That is desperation of some length. There's nothing like a little ongoing desperation to make you flexible. And you don't have to be on Skid Row to have it. As I say, I sponsor a guy who's made $250,000 the last year he drank. He had the same desperation I did. I sponsored the guy who put the flag on the moon, and he had the same desperation I did. And I sponsored movie stars to make all kinds of dough. And they had the same, what do we have in common? We didn't all stand from the midnight mission. We all had the same desperation. But you come here, you don't know what it is. But I'll tell you, the one thing I knew was that I was not really an alcoholic. And I knew it after I went to meetings, because again and again, what do you hear in AA? At least if you're hearing with prejudiced ears, you're sitting there suicidal and depressed and thinking, oh God, and look up and here's some old fool with silvery temples and a $500 suit, and he's saying, friends, I stayed drunk round the clock 25 years. One day I walked through that door, and the desire to drink left me like a cloak fluttering to the floor. I now have $3 million with me tonight. Several different families have returned to me. And I owe it all to one thing. I put the plug in the jug. And sometimes they say things like, and I just feel wonderful. And when you're feeling just like you want to die, that does not elate you. I remember thinking sometimes, wish I had just one curare dart. Just tell us how that feels, you old sumbitch. But I hung around that silly AA, and I even read some of this goofy book. I took actions that were stupid. And I'll tell you, something strange happened. The most important thing I have told you tonight, or I'll say before I sit down, I said, my name is Clancy Immersland, and I'm an alcoholic. I learned that sometime after I was a member of AA. Now, how could you be an alcoholic when your problem really is an alcohol? You may wonder, you may have that problem yourself. How could you be an alcoholic if your problem really is an alcohol? And that, my friends, is what this is all about. I'm glad that I survived long enough, took actions for the worst of motives. The nice thing about AA is, your motives never have to be right. Ever. You just take action, but you curse the son of a bitch that had you take him. Go over and say you're sorry to that woman.
I'm not gonna.
You call her a bitch.
She is a bitch.
Why do you think she's a bitch?
She told her newcomers not to horse around with me.
Well, she's right. Go say you're sorry. Bitch. Don't quit that job.
But they're using me. They're screwing me around, Bob. I'm never going to raise it. Just a bunch of... They're screwing on me. They're crapping on me, Bob.
I don't care. Don't quit that job and get a different one. Go to that meeting.
I'm not going to go to that goddamn meeting. It's a big clique. They're just calling each other. They don't give a shit for people like me. They're all against me, Bob.
They're right. Go to the meeting. Remember when I was about 6 months sober, I lost a job as a dishwasher for being inadequate. I was going to get drunk that night, and my sponsor made me write an inventory, something I swore I'd never do. When you've taken your inventory with a psychiatrist, you shouldn't have to take it with a character actor. I know you mean well, Bob, but this is pretty deep stuff.
Oh, is it just rape shit?
He took me on a ride along the coast highway for 40 miles to Oxnard, and I read at night with a flashlight. Yours, one thing is good about inventories, when you got a good one, yours start off by saying, now I just want to explain this part.
Don't explain, just read the goddamn thing.
We got up near Oxnard, I told him things I had never told my psychiatrist. You know, they say you should tell your psychiatrist everything. Well, when you're paying $75 an hour, you want to risk rejection. I would sure hate to have the psychiatrist say, get out of my office, you sick bastard. So I told him what he needed to know, but
But I was so upset that I wrote this in, but I had stuff in there that I wasn't going to hear all that. I just... We got near oxygen, and I looked over, and he was going, "Oh." I thought I'd made the old man snap. But I've taken that trip maybe 240 times since then, on the driver's side. Well, some other little puke has been over there with it. Now, let me explain this part. And really, it really does get kind of dull, because as exciting as it seems to the reader, it's always the same story generally to the listener. And in about 10 minutes, you can almost tell where the direction is going, where it's going to come out. You know, you can tell when the... Didn't you leave something out there? You've been talking to that bitch? No, but what you do then is what this is, you know. No, no, no. And when I get near oxygen, I'm a much better listener. My sponsor was. I would turn my head. Oh. I sometimes wish I... It's a terrible thing to wish, but I used to find myself a couple years ago just thinking, I hope this guy's got something new. Jeez. There's never anything new. You can only do so many things in your mind and body, and it's a curse to the reader, and it's a boredom to the listener. But one of the great steps, and on and on. But I survived long enough to discover the single most important thing I've ever learned. I'm going to say this slowly tonight, because I know there are a lot of non-alcoholics here, and you might think about this. I survived long enough, for the worst of reasons, the worst of motives, just how I survived, to discover this fact. I'm going to say it slowly, because it sounds so unusual. I came to believe that if my problem is alcohol, I am not an alcoholic. And conversely, if I'm an alcoholic, my problem is not alcohol. Now, doesn't that sound weird and upside down, like some metaphysical spookiness? Is it? But I firmly believe that's what this program is about. That's what this book is about. That's what these meetings are about. I'm sure I must be the only one in this room who sat for an hour with Bill Wilson and talked to him. And that's what he felt it was about, too. As at least in 1963. But you say, how could that be? Of course the problem is alcohol. I can disprove that in 10 seconds. If the problem is alcohol, detoxes turn out winners. And they don't. Hospitals turn out winners, and they don't. Treatment facilities turn out winners, and they don't. Jails turn out winners, and they don't. They turn out people who are sober. They turn out detoxified people, with or without additional data. But the unifying factor of all of them is, unless something strange happens, they all must eventually drink again. Becoming sober does not make you better. It makes you worse. Well, if the problem isn't alcohol, what the hell is it? Is it some spooky thing that just a few old-timers know and won't tell? Is it not this? Where the hell is it? Where do you get the facts? Well, I'll tell you. You hear about it every day, but you don't identify it. It's something that sounds like alcohol, and we talk a lot about drinking in these meetings, but it's not alcohol. It's something called alcoholism. Same thing, alcoholism. That's just crap. Not at all. That dividing line is the dividing line between the 5 out of 100 who will live sober, good lives, and the 95 who will intermittently drink until they die or go mad. What's the difference? What's the difference? The difference is this. I could give you an hour talk of the difference. About a year ago, I was invited to come down to Orlando, Florida, to address a group of psychiatrists and talk to them for an hour on the differences between alcohol problems and the disease of alcoholism, the profile of alcoholism. And when they called me, I felt embarrassed because I could have told them on the phone in 1 minute. But I thought, if I do this, I'll never see Disney World. So, but since you haven't got any Disney World, I can tell you in 1 minute. The difference is this. An alcohol problem is overcome by stopping drinking. In this strange, destructive, illusory,
denigrating, maddening thing called alcoholism, you will discover sooner or later that stopping drinking as such has no significant effect on your life other than to gradually make it so painful that you can't stand it. The deadly aspect of alcoholism is sobriety. That's what makes this illness fatal. Isn't that funny? But even that doesn't make you an alcoholic. That makes you what science describes as an intense or acute neurotic, a person who still lives in reality but cannot cope with it, copes with it obsessively, emotionally, over emotions, all these things. Something else must be present. It turns out, this is a funny number, it can sound like the other number, but about 6% of people who drink alcohol get an unusual reaction to alcohol, unlike what other people get. It isn't that they stay drunk, because nobody can stay drunk. It isn't that you go crazy. I see people die who've never been crazy once. You get just absent, you get catatonic. Is it that you can't handle it? Not at all. Alcoholics handle alcohol better than social drinkers. The unusual reaction is that alcohol must have the unusual power of making everything all right almost instantly. And it's hard to realize it doesn't do that for most people. The best example I know about that, to illustrate that, I was about a year sober. I finally had a little job in an advertising agency. Not much of a job. I still didn't have any front teeth. I was wrapping packages. And that hurt my feelings. I used to be a top executive, and here I was wrapping packages. And one of our accounts was something called Kamchatka Vodka. And they had billboards all over Southern California. They used the same billboard year after year. Vodka is pronounced Kamchatka. They changed the colors, the style, but all of that. Now that, I don't let these copywriters and artists know that there's a brilliant mind back in the production department wrapping these goddamn presents. So I got one day I came by and they were laying out another billboard. I know it's none of my business, it's not my job, but I got just a thought. How about this for a slogan? Kamchatka Vodka goes boom. Better than all vodkas anywhere. And they looked up. I've been getting that look all my life, just. And the one guy says, is that supposed to be some kind of a joke? It isn't funny. And the guy says, you know, you're awfully mouthy for a guy with no teeth. And I was so goddamn, there's nothing in the world worse than public humiliation when you're feeling inadequate. I would have gone over the table and got those two little pukes, but I'd have had to tell my sponsor and he'd have killed me, so I went away and I just was crazy. I almost ran away that day because I was going to make one move and God damn it, they humiliated me. And that day I saw my sponsor and I said, Bob! He said, shh, shh. I said, if you can't be a man, try to act like one. Now what the hell is it? Bob, I'm going to have a billboard. I told this whole story. I said, what makes me most upset, Bob? They just humiliated me intensely. It wasn't, they didn't have to use the slogan, but it was a good slogan, Bob. God damn it, it's a good slogan, and they treat me like a piece of shit because I'm down and they're kicking me. They're just screwing me around, Bob. He said, listen. When he got upset, he'd wave his finger into my nose. Just, it's the only time I really missed my front teeth. I just, son of a bitch. But I didn't want to give him the pleasure of gumming it. Step 12, having had a spiritual awakening as the result of these steps, we try to carry this message to alcoholics. We get a spiritual awakening. You think, well, once I get that, I should be well. But you're not. Bill Wilson had the spiritual experience. 6 months later, he almost drank again because he was discouraged because he couldn't find anybody else to stay sober. His wife had to talk him into staying sober. If a man who was tremendously moved and founded this organization couldn't make it, you don't have to feel bad about being discouraged once in a while. But you have something he didn't have. We have each other and we have a group and we have an ethic. We have a way to go. But you got to keep doing it. And it's very difficult. It's frustrating because I've been sponsoring people for a lot of years. And you get it's become so simple to me. I can't understand why they don't grasp it. And I have to remember, it wasn't 9 years of good people trying to tell me and I wouldn't listen. Because I was sure my case was different. But the best way to describe staying sober, I guess, if you're here in a court card or a just here. You cannot explain to someone how to ride a bicycle. If you ever had children, you know that. And here's what you do. Nothing to it. Get on there, pedal it, and just go down. Jesus Christ, kid. Come on. I don't want to learn to ride the goddamn bicycle. You want to ride? You can show them, but there is no way to tell anybody how to learn a bicycle, to ride a bicycle, because you can't explain it. But if you ride a bicycle and keep falling down, eventually, one day from nowhere, there's no way to explain it, you get a sense of balance, and you can ride a bicycle, and you'll have it as long as you live. And then you can try to teach others who can't learn it till they get the sense of balance. And that's why you're staying sober. Only here we can't wait for you to fall down again and again, so we have you take actions whether or not you believe in them. They say, what's AA all about? That's something to remember. Alcoholics Anonymous is not a meeting. It's not a convention. It's not love. It's not understanding. It's none of these things. All of these things were available long before AA. What it is this. The bottom line of AA as it is today is that exactly as it was on June 10th, 1935. We were talking about it at dinner. One alcoholic talking to another alcoholic to help him reduce his feelings of being different enough so that he will begin to take actions he does not yet believe in. And everything beyond that is lanyap, extra. That's what we're doing, that's what we do at the meetings, that's what we do on 12-step calls. That's primarily what we do. We must do these things to keep our own feelings of being different in check. Because if they become obsessive again, I will drink and die. The last thing I want to say is that a lot of people still question AA. Is it enough for sensitive, intense people? The best psychiatrist I ever knew told me I would have to take sedatives as long as I lived because of the intensity of my emotions. I have had shock treatments. I have had cold towel therapy, cold frozen sheet therapy. I've been in a lot of things. But somehow here, with the worst of motives, something changed. I've not had a drink or a pill for something over 30 years. That's it. Don't applaud. Take a love offering. Help keep us on the air, friends. Jesus Christ. Stand up and say hello, Tammy. The reason I know Alcoholics Anonymous works is that I live in the world today, and I give you a little hope. After a while, I'm finding when I changed my attitude enough, I became successful. I got back in radio and television, became very successful, and just took off. And after a few years, same family and all those kids moved back. We had more kids, and just wonderful. And they've all been in my house for Christmas, and all many, many grandchildren. At one time, I went 7.5 days without going to the bathroom. Tell you that, my eyes turned brown. And after about 15 years of being a success, in a moment of AA frenzy, I found myself resigning a job in Beverly Hills. What I do for the last 15 years, I run the mission in Skid Row they threw me out of in 1958. And it's at an alcoholic treatment center. We're way below that. We just watch people die, and occasionally we can get somebody out of there. But some of them are alcoholics, some aren't. This is an alcoholic treatment facility. And sometimes I go to work in the morning, I think, what the hell am I going down to Skid Row again to watch more people die? I should be up going to that elevator in Beverly Hills in my shiny suit. And I'm slick. But a lot of nights when I get on that freeway going home, I think to myself, my holes are more filled than they ever were going down all those elevators, popping my fingers and being slick. What I want to tell you is this. You can debate with your little friends around the back of a bar or in the back row of a meeting whether or not AA works. But you can't debate it with me. Because I tell you, AA works. Do it. Thank you. Yeah.